The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. We have a Labor Day holiday coming up, so let me take this opportunity to wish all of you holiday greetings, Labor Day happiness for your families and whatever you plan to do, and above all, keep it safe, keep looking up. And we have a great space show for you tonight. Dr. Jeff Faust is back with us, one of our all-time favorites, dating back to the beginnings almost 20 years ago of the space show. More about Jeff in just a minute. A couple of quick announcements to make. Because of the Labor Day holiday, there is no John Batchelor show tomorrow. He's taking off, and Hotel Mars is his program, so that won't happen. We do have a special off-topic space show for tomorrow night, and I go off-topic 3 or 4 or 5 times a year, and this is one of the times we're going off-topic with a very interesting indie film project about the DeLorean car. And you may think that's really weird for the space show, but it's interesting to me, and I think many of you may be interested in it too. So we have the film producer, Jordan, who is going to be with us for a 60-minute program tomorrow night as an off-topic space show program. And get rid of your bias, because it's not space, it's not about nozzles and all of that, but it is about cool engineering. And I think you'll like it, and I think you'll be interested in the film project. So that is tomorrow at 7 p.m. Ted Southern takes us back to Space Talk on Friday morning, so he has Final Frontier Design Spacesuit Company, and he will talk about his commercial spacesuit line that he is working on at the Brooklyn Naval Yard, and spacesuits in general. And again, because of the Labor Day holiday, there will be no space show on Sunday. Everybody will be off doing Labor Day holiday, hopefully family or fun things. And above all, as I said before, keeping it very, very safe. We want you back on the next Tuesday Space Show program. So for tonight, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So do remember, the Space Show is a talk show, which generally means we talk, right? So it is our preferred way of communicating with our guest, and we hope you will use the toll-free phone number tonight. So let me put it out there one more time again, 1-866-687-7223. Now, for those of you just totally adamant that you're not going to pick up the phone and make a call, or because you don't have a voice or who knows what, you can use email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Plus, you can post on our blog, which is thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu. And this is the first program listed. Open that page up. It is our archive and blog page. And you can scroll all the way to the bottom for comments. And as soon as you write your question or comment and hit send, I'll get a copy of it. And I can bring it up on air and deliver it to our guest, Dr. Jeff Faust. But once again, the preferred way is 1-866-687-7223. And we hope you will use the phone tonight. A couple of other quick things to tell you about. The website newsletter is up and running on our homepage, thespaceshow.com. Check it out for all of the activities for this week, but also scroll down to the future activities, and you can see the programming we already have planned that is going to take us into the end of 2019. I can't believe I'm saying that, and we're still in summertime. Everything we do is archived, as you know, so you can listen right off of our website or quickly and easily download a program. We do have a space show store, and all you have to do is click on a picture of Pepper listening to the space show on any of those homepage pictures, and Pepper will guide you to Cafe Press, where hopefully you'll find some items of interest. And your feedback, of course, is always welcome about that store. Up at the top, there is a Listen Live button that tells you how to listen to live shows like we're doing right now. Archives on our website, which are compressed MP3s. And then podcasts, and some of the podcast players that we use are embedded on our homepage, on that page, Listen Live. Plus Alexa, and Alexa does do some of the same podcasting clients that we're using. So you can listen to Alexa if you're an Alexa user. If you have any podcasting questions, don't hesitate to email me, and the best way to do that is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do also remember that we are a listener-supported program, and we're a 501c3 nonprofit. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we exist because many of you do financially support us, and we thank you very much for that support. So do remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, your gift is tax-deductible. If you're a California taxpayer, your gift is tax-deductible, as we're a public benefit corporation in California. If you have any questions about this, check it out with your own tax advisor, or you can bounce it off of me. Maybe I can help you. DrSpace@thespaceshow.com. Check out our website for our nonprofit, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we absolutely appreciate and need your support. The year is more than half over now. We're coming into the final part of the year, so funding always looks like, is there enough to last for the rest of the year? So do support us, and if you like our shows and our guests and what we're doing, not only do we want you to support us, but we want your suggestions, and we certainly want to hear from you. In addition to the individual support, which you can do by using the PayPal button on our homepage over on the upper right side, or writing a check, that check information is on the same PayPal link, or by buying things through Amazon and letting Amazon support us, which they do for nonprofits. That is explained if you click on the big Amazon button in the middle of our homepage. But we do also have sponsors, and the sponsors get a banner ad going across our homepage, and you can change that banner as often as you like. And in addition, on full-length shows, which is what we're doing tonight, I read a short message from each of our sponsors. Some of them go off in the first segment. Some of them are in the second segment. So for the first segment of tonight's program, Northrop Grumman is a sponsor, and they're a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions to the government and commercial customers globally. They have all sorts of great capabilities and technologies for applications ranging from undersea to outer space, including cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us. They're coming up on the 36th Space Symposium. It is in April and again at the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs. It is a must-attend industry event with networking like you've never seen before. It's nothing like an advocate type of conference. In fact, Jeff Faust, our guest today, frequently attends the Space Foundation meetings. He can attest to all that. I would dare anyone to see the entire exhibit hall in detail in one day. I don't think you can do it. And for networking, if you just hung out in the exhibit hall, you'd be in seventh heaven for the rest of the year. So their website is spacesymposium.org. And the Space Foundation is spacefoundation.org. So I urge you to please check it out. I mentioned the DeLorean movie tomorrow night, but also the DeLorean is a new sponsor for the space show. So they have a banner ad, and it's Living the Dream. And this is the only documentary that's ever been produced about the history of the DeLorean car and the incredible DeLorean international community, told firsthand by the people that who personally helped build it and continue to live the dream that is DeLorean. And if their fundraising goals are not met, these moving, uplifting, and at times inspiring portraits of DeLorean dreamers could be lost in time forever. This is really an incredible timepiece. You can pre-order a copy of the movie. You can get a DeLorean But you have to go check that out on the site and share with us with your friends. To find out more about this crowdfunding event and the movie, check the DeLorean page for tomorrow night on the Space Show. That page is already up. And if you click on the DeLorean banner ad, it will take you to their Kickstarter page for more information. AIAA sponsors us, one of my favorite organizations. And they have 5 events a year, but a lot more regional lunches and sometimes breakfast and dinner. And I think the country is divided into different regions. And the people that are members, the engineers, actually work in the field. So they are shaping the future of aerospace all the time. As a member, you can access their library of peer-reviewed papers. It goes back for decades. I used their library extensively when writing my doctoral dissertation back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. So you do not have to be an engineer to be a member. I'm a non-engineering member of AIAA, which is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. You should join it. You should check it out. You should attend the events. And once again, networking, which is just off this planet Earth, it's amazing. And Jeff Faust is our guest today, and it's great, great, great to have Jeff back. And Jeff is an editor of the is the editor of the Space Review, and he's a senior staff writer for Space Policy. And you hear from him all the time. He's frequently on Hotel Mars and comes on the Space Show just about every year or so. You go to conferences, you will see Dr. Jeff Faust at that conference. And if you don't walk up and introduce yourself, you're missing out. We're happy to have Jeff back with us tonight, and you can read his full bio on the website. It is already posted up there. Jeff, welcome back to the Space Show. It's always great to talk to you. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you, David, for the invitation. Like you said, I've been with you and John Batchelor on Hotel Mars several times, but it's been a while since I've been here on the flagship Space Show, so it's good to be back.
Flagship program, that's kind of like flagships on the moon, right? For John Hunt, who sent me an email and said that my volume was low, John, I turned it up. If you think the volume is still low, please email me. But I cranked it up about as high as it can go. It is in distortion category on my view meter, so please do give me feedback on that. And Jeff, it was great seeing you at ISDC. We'll talk about some of that in just a few minutes. But SpaceX tested Starhopper about 2.5 hours ago. You told me about it when I called you. I've been busy setting up alternative power for the space show in case we have power outages here. Give us a report on Starhoppers and the test.
Yeah, the flight took place, for those listening live, about 4 hours ago, a little after 6 o'clock Eastern time, 5 o'clock out at their South Texas test site near Brownsville. Starhopper, for those who aren't familiar with it, is sort of an early-stage prototype of SpaceX's Starship Next Generation Reusable Launch Vehicle. It's designed for only very low-altitude takeoff and landing tests. Some people might remember the Grasshopper vehicle that SpaceX had several years back when it was testing reusing the Falcon 9. This is sort of analogous to that, but for Starship. It took off, flew to an altitude of about 150 meters, 500 feet or so, moved to a side by about a similar distance, and then landed on another pad. The whole flight from takeoff to landing took just under a minute. As far as we can tell from those of us watching the webcast of the event, it seemed to go as expected. The company hasn't released a lot of details about the flight. Elon Musk said he was proud of the SpaceX team, but didn't disclose other details. But it looks like a successful test, and so another step forward for SpaceX as they work on this ambitious next-generation launch system.
What does Starhopper lead to? Give us sort of the chronology of, okay, they test Starhopper. How many times do they test it? Where do they go next?
Yeah, this is actually supposed to be, according to Musk, the last test of Starhopper. They're going to move on to what they call a Starship Mark 1, which would be a prototype of the actual Starship vehicle, which is the upper stage of the overall launch system. There's a booster section called Super Heavy that would carry Starship on top. They've been working on actually a couple of these prototypes, one at the South Texas test site, another in Florida, not far from Cape Canaveral. And so in the coming months, they're going to have those vehicles ready to start doing some test flights from Texas and also presumably from Florida as well, that could eventually lead to them going into orbit, although they'll still need to develop the Super Heavy booster for the full-fledged launch system. Should keep in mind that those timescales which SpaceX puts out are sometimes a little, I think, success-oriented is the term. The dates may slip by weeks or months, but they seem to be on track towards getting those vehicles ready for testing sometime in the not-too-distant future.
So you called it Starship Mach 1. Is that what you said it was?
Starship Mark 1, yeah.
Mark 1, okay. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't hear. I should tell everybody who've been with me at conferences, I finally broke down and got hearing aids. So we'll see how that works the next time I attend a conference. I got sick and tired of missing what everybody says, even when they're standing in front of me. So, good news for SpaceX, and as I told you, I've been working with my engineer to bring in generator power here, but I've not gotten any alerts on this. I have no email news services. I don't even have listeners telling me, did you hear, did you hear? Usually that's off the chart, and all of a sudden I'll start getting alerts from all the different blogs and from this and that. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Why is that?
That's a good question. I know the space-focused media covered it pretty closely. Certainly we did at Space News. I think a lot of the other people that cover space closely were following the flight and wrote about it. I don't think it's necessarily a milestone that would necessarily get the interest of the broader mainstream media, because it is a fairly low altitude brief test. Nothing went into space. Nothing was supposed to go into space on this test. So I think it's something that the industry was very interested in, but not necessarily something that translates into broader public interest.
Since we're speaking about Starship sort of indirectly, you got a very early email from Dr. Doug down in the wonderful part of Los Angeles. And let me read it to you because it's kind of relevant to this part of the discussion. It seems to me, Jeff, that NASA and the decision makers say little of anything about Starship despite the considerable progress that it is making. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think, they are certainly following what's going on with Starship. I think at this point, though, it still seems, I don't want to say quite hypothetical, but still something that it doesn't exist yet. The vehicle is still in development. It's not clear exactly how long it's going to take for this vehicle to be ready to enter service. So it's difficult to incorporate that into planning in the same way as you would vehicles that are in service now, or vehicles that are under development that NASA has some control over, notably the Space Launch System.
Do they consider it a PowerPoint rocket at this stage, and they just blow it off?
I consider it a PowerPoint rocket. Obviously the test earlier today is a demonstration that there is literally flying hardware to support this, but it's still in a very early stage development, and it's not necessarily something that they have a lot of insight into. Now, if in a couple of years Starship and Super Heavy start flying, I think that will change the calculus in terms of what NASA does in terms of incorporating that vehicle into its exploration plans. But I think for the time being, it's difficult to for them, at least, to adjust their plans based on a vehicle that is still in what appears to be a fairly early stage in development, and something like that, again, is something that's being developed outside of the agency, and they don't have, you know, any oversight and very little insight into its development.
And they're not doing very well with the vehicle they have oversight on, so something seems a little amiss here, but I guess because it's their vehicle, they feel more comfortable about it.
Right. I mean, there's plenty of criticism that can be directed at the SLS because of its numerous delays, but it is the program of record for NASA, and it's something that the agency is charged with developing and is funded to work on. So obviously that's going to be front and center in their plans, even though it suffered, you know, significant delays that have pushed back its first launch probably into 2021.
Speaking of SLS, Andrew, who is in Spokane, sent in a note and says, in your opinion, does SLS still enjoy bipartisan support?
I think it certainly does enjoy bipartisan support. Obviously the key individual for SLS is Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, who happens to be the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. So he has a lot of influence into what gets funded or not funded as the appropriations process goes on. And obviously keeps a very close tab on SLS because it's managed by the Marshall Space Flight Center in his state. So I think SLS certainly has, continued support. People wonder, people ask, what happens when Starship comes along or when Blue Origin's New Glenn enter service or something like that? Isn't that the end of SLS? It's hard to see SLS going away under this Congress and this administration, to be certain, especially as long as Richard Shelby is in a position of influence in Congress, because he has shown no sign of any sort of wavering support. In fact, just the opposite, ensuring that the SLS program continues and gets funded and sometimes increases its funding over administration requests for the program. And, Shelby's term runs through 2022, and it's not clear if he'll run for another six-year term when that time comes. So it's hard to see, in the near term, certainly through the 2020 election and beyond, that there being a sudden change of course where Congress sours on SLS to the point where its funding is in jeopardy simply because of the influence people like Senator Shelby have.
If we can, unless you want to do something different, let's jump to the plans to return to the moon. Now, you were at ISDC, so Scott Pace was there speaking about our plans to go back to the moon, and NASA Administrator Bridenstine was there speaking about plans to go back to the moon. And there were some disgruntled people in both audiences that spoke out against the way NASA is choosing to go back to the moon. They're not happy about it. Most of my audience is not happy about it. And the funding seems to be up in the air, and also because it's an election year, it's up in the air. So you heard all of the big guys, and you're there in the Beltway. So how do you see it? What are we going back to the moon, even briefly, for 2024 and on to 2028? Or is Newt Gingrich and the general going to have their contest and have a race between SpaceX and Bezos to go to the moon directly? What's happening now?
Yeah, I mean, NASA's plans, obviously, as you mentioned, call for a human return to the moon, specifically the south polar region of the moon, by the end of 2024. That is the goal and the plan that NASA is working towards. Certainly that is going to be a difficult goal to achieve, even in the best of circumstances, given that almost every major space program, government or commercial, suffers delays and cost overruns. And there's not a lot of slack in that schedule for 2024 lunar landing. That said, NASA is pressing ahead with support from the administration on this 2024 plan. At the National Space Council meeting last week here in the D.C. area, Vice President Pence said, he was satisfied with what NASA was doing, saying their plans were on track. He did give NASA some homework to do in terms of firming up the schedules for SLS and the Orion spacecraft. But, certainly he seemed continued to support the 2024 goal that he announced at the previous Space Council meeting back in March. The challenge, as you sort of alluded to, is the funding. And the first hurdle is for the fiscal year 2020 spending bills that Congress is working on. In fact, the House has already passed their versions of the bill. The Senate has not. NASA is seeking an additional $1.6 billion on top of its original request to support the Artemis program, in particular the lunar landers that are an essential element of the Artemis program. The House didn't include that $1.6 billion in part because the request came as it was finishing up its own version of the spending bills back in May. The Senate hasn't taken up their bills yet. They're working on them now, and we may start to see some action when the Senate returns from its summer break after Labor Day. But whatever the Senate comes up with will have to be reconciled with the House version, so there'll be opportunities to get some or all of that funding in. I would not be surprised if NASA did end up getting that $1.6 billion or something very close to it to support the Artemis program in 2020. The challenge is going to be what happens in 2021 when they start working, next spring on the spending bills for fiscal year 2021, because NASA will need a lot more than $1.6 billion in additional funding for Artemis. It's probably going to be on the order of several billion dollars. How much the program costs is something NASA's been kind of coy about. Administrator Bridenstine said in one interview he estimated it would cost $20 to $30 billion in additional funding over a five-year period. He sort of backed away from those numbers somewhat, but it's clear that it's going to be much more than $1.6 billion that they'll need in 2021, and potentially even more than that in 2022 and 2023. I think Congress is going to be a lot less receptive to the much greater spending increases when they start taking up the 2021 spending bills sometime next year. Especially if it's not all new money, that is an increase in the overall NASA budget, but if NASA tries to take money away from science programs or from space technology or from operations of the space station, all programs that enjoy significant support and cuts to which members of Congress would strongly object to. But that's sort of a battle for later on. The near-term battle is getting the 2020 spending bills in place. And in that case, I think there's a good chance they will get, like I said, most or all of that $1.6 billion to allow work to continue on the lunar landers, get SLS moving forward, things like that. But what happens after that? With the added complication that we'll have an election next November, the potential for a new president in office in January of 2021 that would shake things up further. But like I said, those are longer term issues, and the nearer term issue is just getting it funded for 2020.
You have another email. Kerry is in Chicago, and he says Jeff David is always pointing out the increasing debt, the interest on the national debt, and these kind of problems. From your perspective and the people you hear about in D.C., do any of them even care about the debt, and they can just throw around a couple of billion here, a couple of billion there, whether it's for our agenda or Joe Blow's down the street, doesn't seem to matter. They're just willing to spend and not pay attention to the debt and the interest and the issues about the economy. What is your take on that?
Yeah, there certainly are some members of Congress, fiscally conservative members, that do care about the debt. And although it's interesting that even with Republicans in control up until for the first years of this administration, the budget deficits grew significantly, even though the Republicans were the party, at least at one point, of fiscal conservatism. That didn't quite work out when they actually took up spending bills and tax cut bills and so on. Certainly there's a long-term risk of what that increasing debt will do for the economy. It's a little bit out of my wheelhouse in terms of what the implications are. NASA, to keep in mind, is a very small part of the overall federal budget. It's about 0.5% of the federal budget, even with some of the budget increases it's seen in recent years. So, you know, NASA is only a very small part of the problem and therefore can be only a very small part of the solution. If you want to tackle the national debt, you're going to have to take on much bigger issues regarding revenue and entitlement spending and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. So the contest that Newt and General Quast and others have proposed, how do you see that coming into play with Artemis and the national program to go to the moon? And does it have any legs? Does it have any backers? Do you think that a $2 billion prize, is it going to happen?
You know, I have not seen in the week or so since the first reports came out about the proposed prize any real groundswell of support from members of Congress to back it. Now, to be honest, Congress is on recess right now. A lot of members are back in their home districts. They're not paying close attention to space issues, even if they ever are paying close attention to space issues. So a lot of members may not have simply have thought about it or even necessarily heard about it. But you have not seen those who really care about space step forward and say, yes, we need to do something like this. We need to support this bill. And I think one of the issues with large prize programs in general is that, you know, it's Congress gives up a lot of the oversight that it would have for a traditional program. If you're funding a program, you can control the funding levels. You can put in provisions directing an agency like NASA to go in a specific direction in a program. But the prize program, you can't. You put up the prize purse, the rules are set, and then whoever wins, or if anybody wins. But you don't have any real control of the program beyond that, including, you know, putting in provisions that might benefit the constituents in your state or district, which is often the case with federal spending programs in general.
Well, they don't want the government to have any oversight. That's how they claim the private sector can move fast and more effectively and more efficiently. So the last thing they want is the government to get involved. They just want the government's money.
Yeah, and I think that's why any sort of prize program like that would have difficulty winning support in Congress, because Congress always wants to be involved and have some say in the program.
Your best
not
guess.
And not just be simply the person that writes the $2 billion check.
Your best guess, does it happen, and what do you personally think about it?
I don't see it happening anytime soon, simply because there does not seem to be a lot of interest by members of Congress so far, or by a lot of people in the space industry that would participate. I know Elon Musk has come out and said he thinks it's a good idea. I have not heard from Jeff Bezos. But certainly there would be a lot of people in the established aerospace industry that would consider a program like that a potential threat to the existing program of record, even if it's being sold as it is as sort of a plan B, an alternate to the current path, but not a replacement for it. I still think you'd see a lot of opposition towards that from a lot of the mainstream aerospace industry. That's why I really don't see a lot of support for the prize program right now and don't expect it, at least any time in the near future, to move ahead.
Listeners, our phone line is available. If you would like to call us, let me provide that number for you again, 1-866-687-7223. And then, of course, email, as you're currently using, can continue, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And there is time for your call before our break, so don't let that stop you from calling. Remember, it is a talk show, and we'd love to hear you talk. So 1-866-687-7223. What else do you see as being a pretty hot space topic? One that maybe is getting by our attention, but you see it from your vantage point, and it should be getting our attention.
Well, I mean, we've talked a lot about NASA's exploration programs and some of the challenges that they're facing for moving ahead. I think, one of the other hot political issues is the potential formation of a Space Force or an organization that will carry the Space Force name that Congress is currently debating. The House and Senate, have their own what are called National Defense Authorization Acts, which are defense policy bills. The House and Senate versions have their own language, which differ from each other on creating a Space Force within the Air Force. And they're working to reconcile that. And we may see sometime next month a final version of that bill hammered out between the House and Senate that would likely contain language creating a Space Force. The question will be whether it matches up with what the administration was looking for in its own proposal for a Space Force, and what they would do about that. But, that's certainly a significant milestone. It's obviously been a priority for the president, but a lot of people who follow military space policy say it's time that space get more attention within the military than it does with the way it's currently structured within the Air Force, and that creating a separate service or something like that would be a means of doing so. So, well, that's something to watch for certainly in the coming weeks. And separate to that, we're going to see the stand-up this week of U.S. Space Command. There used to be a U.S. Space Command back during the 80s and 90s up until shortly after 9/11. But it's going to return as what's formally called a combatant command within the U.S. military to oversee space operations. And so we're seeing sort of, signs that space is being seen in national security circles as something that deserves its own commands, its own structures for it to be properly funded and properly organized and properly run, given the importance of space to all other military space operations on land, sea, or air.
General Quast was on the program last week. And he is a very, very passionate advocate of why we need a full-blown Space Force, although, he's willing to go the route and grow sort of a Marine Corps relationship to the Navy program with the Air Force. But he also lays out a very real and serious case about what we have to do to maintain space leadership and stay ahead of what China is doing. I ask him, as well as listeners, ask him if China is being used as a fear bait thing, and he does not think that it is. He thinks it's a real issue. I'm curious as to how you see China in all of this. Do we have a genuine reason to be concerned? Is it overblown? How do you see it? And I'm sure you've heard General Quast talk before. Your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah. Well, I think the answer can be a combination of both. Yes, there is reason to be concerned about China's growing space capabilities, including its capabilities to threaten our military space assets. But I think we have to be careful about getting too carried away about what they're really capable of and what they're doing in space. I think it's been a long-held aspect of American space policy, going back more than a decade or so, that we've treated China as this immovable force that's coming that they're going to take over everything in space, and they're going to land humans on the moon any day now, and so on. And reality is that they're not moving necessarily as quickly as we've ever anticipated. That what they their plans aren't necessarily as clear-cut as what we think they are. They certainly, their activities certainly do pose a threat to our military space assets, and we should, you know, keep that in mind in terms of improving our ability to monitor space activities and to be able to defend our space assets as needed. I think we just need to be careful about getting too carried away with some of the predictions that you see about what China is going to do or rumored to be able to do in space in the next couple of decades. I'm reminded of testimony that Mike Griffin gave more than a decade ago when he was still NASA administrator, and they were pursuing the Constellation program, which was calling for landing humans on the moon by 2020. And you know, he was playing up the, you know, China's space capabilities and sort of seemed almost resigned to the fact that, yeah, China's going to beat us to the moon. Well, you know, China has not landed a human on the moon, and it's almost 2020, and it seems like, you know, their human space program is moving at a relatively slow pace, and it seems unlikely that they will land humans on the moon at least for the next decade or so, unless there's a significant change in their plans and capabilities. So we need to be a little careful about projecting too much about what they're capable of doing or projecting our own insecurities onto their capabilities.
The general talked specifically about their advancements in electromagnetic and grid work, which, as he said, was of great concern to us, and also Chinese laws and culture being the main for going into space and not what the U.S. offers, and not freedom and some of the things that we stand for, as opposed to China, which you see playing out in Hong Kong at the moment. Those were areas of big concern of his, and why he was so eloquently and passionately advocating for a full space force. Any of these concerns resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, in any situation, whoever gets there first to the moon or to Mars or wherever is the opportunity to set the rules, and you prefer it's you know, someone following the Western norms and not necessarily, you know, Chinese ones. But again, you know, we don't want to project a little too far in terms of what their true ambitions are. They have, you know, they are like us. They are human. They have to deal with their own set of politics and their own set of issues. And rocket technology is just as hard for them as it is for us.
You have a caller waiting to talk to you. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you, and thank you for calling.
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
I was reading something in Space News about the Russians having problems docking their Soyuz MS-13. And I thought, well, is this an indication that the Russians are really still coasting along and not really making any new steps in space?
Yeah, good question, Marshall. The spacecraft in question is actually Soyuz MS-14. It was sort of an unusual Soyuz mission that there was nobody on board. This was actually a test flight of the spacecraft because Russia is switching the version of the Soyuz rocket that it will use to launch the Soyuz spacecraft. And they wanted to fly the spacecraft on this new version of the Soyuz rocket called the Soyuz 2.1A on an uncrewed mission first. And so they launched it last Wednesday. Launch went perfectly fine. Spacecraft was on a trajectory to arrive at the station late Friday night. But there was a problem with the automated docking system that they use for the Soyuz and also for the Progress cargo spacecraft. So they backed off. They decided to move another Soyuz spacecraft that was already there from one docking port to the docking port that the new Soyuz spacecraft was trying to go to, so that they could, you know, use a different set of the equipment for the automated docking system. And so late Monday night, they tried again, and the docking went perfectly fine. So what it was probably a problem with the hardware on that particular docking port for that automated docking system, and that's something that presumably can get replaced. Send up some replacement hardware and replace it at some point. So in terms of overall station operations, it's not that big of an issue. And certainly there are technical glitches. I don't want to say all the time, but on a regular basis on the space station, things break down. They have to be fixed. Sometimes they require spacewalks to fix it. Just as you have to do regular maintenance on your home. And sometimes you have to repair a broken window or some, shingles on the roof. You have to do some maintenance on the space station as well. There's a bigger issue, though, that I think that you sort of hinted at your question, Marshall, is that, what are Russia's space capabilities and are they degrading to some degree? And certainly we've seen evidence of that. There are additional modules that Russia wants to add to their segment of the space station, but they have been delayed by years. They have suffered a variety of technical problems, and their launch has kept being pushed back, and that's one of the reasons why there are only two Russian cosmonauts on the station right now instead of three. Russia decided that they don't need a third cosmonaut to handle the activities on their portion of the station, and they can make some money by selling that seat to NASA. NASA can have an extra astronaut on the space station and also provide a little bit of extra coverage for the delays in the commercial crew program. So certainly there's a concern about, are there issues with the Russian space capabilities? You might also remember last October we had the aborted Soyuz launch that required the Soyuz to escape its booster rocket and parachute back down. Fortunately, the two people on board were just fine, and they were actually able to fly again to the space station earlier this year. But you certainly worry about, the capabilities of the Russian program, and will that have an impact on the overall safety of the space station down the road? Right now, we haven't seen any sort of direct evidence of safety issues with space station operations because of that, but it's certainly something that I suspect that NASA and the other international partners will be watching closely, because we are still dependent on the Soyuz for accessing the space station, and likely will be until at least sometime early next year, hopefully. We'll see what happens with the commercial crew program. But certainly rely on the Russians, for other aspects of space station operations, just as the Russians rely on NASA for some aspects of space station operations. So it's something to keep a close eye on, but I don't think this particular incident is a cause for alarm, because it did seem to be just a technical glitch that could be worked out in a fairly straightforward fashion.
Now, let me go to the next little fun ditty here, and that is the humanoid robot known as Fedor. And, are they really doing human-robot type things, or is this something more like Elon Musk putting his robot into his Tesla to drive it through space?
Yeah, the Soyuz that just launched didn't have any astronauts on board, but it did have a humanoid robot called Fedor. Also, they call it Skybot F-850. I'm not sure exactly why it's Skybot F-850 instead of, Skybot F-100 or 1000. But it is a robot that, looks a little bit like a science fiction humanoid robot. It's only going to be on the space station for a couple weeks. They want to do some tests to see how it can operate in space and how it can assist cosmonauts in doing operations, and then they will stow it back in that Soyuz spacecraft and have it return to Earth early next month. Now, Fedor is not the first humanoid robot to be on the space station. NASA, you might remember, had the Robonaut, actually Robonaut 2, on the space station for a number of years, doing tests again to see, can a robot, help take off some of the burden of the workload that astronauts have. You know, they have to do all sorts of space station maintenance activities, but also have a full slate of experiments to do, and so that takes up a lot of time. And if you have some sort of robotic assistant that can handle some of the more mundane activities or simply help out in holding tools or something while you're doing a task, that can be helpful. That Robonaut that NASA had on the space station suffered some problems a couple years back, and it turns out it had some flaws in its electrical system. So they sent it back down to Earth, they've repaired it, and they're hoping to launch it back to the space station late this year. So Robonaut 2 will be back in space hopefully by the end of this year. They've got some tests planned for it. Robonaut 2 will not overlap with Fedor. You know, I don't know if that's a good or a bad sign. If you want two humanoid robots up there, sounds like, again, the setup for a bad science fiction movie, but,
that was what I was thinking, yes.
Yeah. So the idea of having robotic assistants to help NASA astronauts or Russian cosmonauts is not a new idea. And there are other, they don't have to be humanoid robots. They have, what they call astrobees, which are these little floating ones that move around the station that can provide an extra set of eyes or an extra set of tools to help out with station operations. But it's something to keep an eye on, as you try to help reduce the workload on astronauts, but also think ahead about future missions, whether it's the Lunar Gateway or missions to Mars or so on, where having assistance for astronauts could be helpful as well.
You know, that's one of the key questions that I have since I worked, on robotic systems for assembly lines, for, mundane things like drilling the holes in an F-16 wing. Robots need to do something, and it's kind of like, well, this Fedor doesn't sound like it's really doing anything, and you really have to take some time to judge whether or not they're really that useful and not just a political show toy.
Yeah, and I think this is an experiment to see how well it can work, and does it really help with assisting cosmonauts, or does it take more time to set it up and operate it than it would be if you simply had the cosmonauts do the tasks on their own? That's something that I assume they'll be testing over the next couple of weeks. That probably won't be a lot of time to get a lot of insight into it, but maybe a step in that direction. It's interesting to note that I've heard from NASA that the Russians are interested in Robonaut 2 as well, and so it's likely that when Robonaut 2 returns to the space station at the end of this year, that some of the experiments will be done in cooperation with Russian cosmonauts, because they're interested in learning more about these technologies as well.
Yeah, that's a real compliment right there. If some other group of people who are totally independent want to use it, that's a pretty good sign. It's probably useful.
Well, we'll find out. We'll see how useful these are. That's the point of these experiments, is that you often discover that what you thought they might be useful for isn't that useful, but they can do things you had not anticipated doing in the first place. And so, that's why, testing on the ground is great and all, but it's really important to get that hardware into space and get it tested in the real environment and see how well it works.
Yeah. I'll clear the line and let somebody else ask a few questions.
Thank you, Marshall. Listeners, Marshall has, in fact, cleared the line. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And Jeff, we're going to go to break.
Okay.
Because it's about that time. So listeners, Jeff and I will be back in a couple of minutes. Enjoy the music. And again, we do answer the phone if you want to call us and stay on hold. 1-866-687-7223. Stay where you are, everybody. We'll be right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody, to part two of our program. We do have second segment sponsors that I want to thank very much and read their messages. Moonwords is a sponsor. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit Moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we leave our past behind us. And then, in addition, the Space Development Network sponsors, and they're focused on space settlement. Would you like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime? The Space Development Network is a free online organization allowing you to join together with others to advance the plan for space development. They're looking for people with a wide variety of interests and skills. It's free, as I said, to join, and you can check it all out at developspace.info. And then Celesta sponsors us. So do remember that they are the iconic pioneer Memorial Spaceflight Services since 1997. And when the time comes and you want to have some of your ashes or DNA flown in space on a Celestis Memorial Spaceflight, you can choose Earth orbit, the moon, or an infinite voyage into the depths of space. How do you make that happen? You contact Celesta, and you can prearrange your memorial spaceflight. And they're easy to work with. Remember, I've done three memorial spaceflights with my mom and my two dogs. And it is really a moving ceremony and process. And they're a great company to work with, and they make it very, very easy to do it. So you can learn a lot more about prearranging your own memorial spaceflight or that of a loved one, and to do that, contact Celestis, CelesTis.com. And then also the National Space Society sponsored us, so remember, they produce big events like ISDC. It'll be at the end of May in 2020 at Frisco, Texas. And then they also do space settlement workshops and other things, plus they have the great magazine Ad Astra, which is quarterly, and it's also a nonprofit, and you should be a member. So check out space.nss.org. And then also the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor. They just successfully completed their Kickstarter program. This is the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming spacefaring. You can see how the technologies and destinations join together. This is on the virtual one. But you can also buy a space plan at thespaceplan.com. You can get it in two different kinds, and it's inspiring. You can hang it on the wall or the door. It's a good teaching tool if you have younger ones around the house. So check it all out at thespaceplan.com, and there will soon be a 2019 space plan and a space race poster that was funded in their Kickstarter program. So Jeff Faust is with us. We're in segment two, and once again, the phone number, 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. We talked a little bit on other space show programs, but there's also this thing where Mr. Musk sort of suggested that he could nuke Mars for terraforming, and that sort of caused a little bit of a turmoil. Do you take that seriously? Do you think he was just a little bravado, or how do you read that?
It's something that I suspect that he seriously thinks about, but also realizes it's not anything that's going to be done in the near, immediate, even into the long term, given the tremendous technical challenges, but also likely the regulatory and political and public interest issues involved with trying to terraform a planet, whether you do that with nukes, whether you do it with solar power, as he suggested an alternative might be, or however you do it. Certainly there's a lot of questions posed by that. So, we're still working right now on getting Starship flying so that, he can get humans to Mars at some point in the 2020s or 2030s. Terraforming is a lot longer down the road. And who knows what technologies will be like and what our understanding of Mars will be like that could enable or jeopardize any sort of terraforming plan.
So you're not excited by that one?
It's not something that I pay a lot of attention to simply because I don't see much happening on that front. Likely for the remainder of my professional career in this field, simply because it's such a long-term and endeavor.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi there. How you doing? You speak up, okay?
Okay, yes. I was wanting to talk about the SpaceX Starship program, and my thing of this is it looks to me like he's bit off more than he really can chew here with this thing. Can he really build this thing? I mean, really? With the resources he has?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, John. We are seeing, though, that they are making a lot of progress with prototypes. Besides the Starhopper vehicle that flew today, there are two prototypes of the Starship, what they call the Starship Mark I vehicle, under construction, one in Texas, one in Florida. It's interesting that the company has taken the approach of doing those two in parallel with separate teams. Elon Musk has mentioned that the idea is for them to be competitive, that they do have to share the insights that they gain separately from the process, but they don't have to incorporate them. They can go their own approach. So it's sort of an internal competition of sorts, which is an unusual way to run a development program. But you can see it does have certain potential benefits in terms of working out, finding different approaches and seeing which one works out best. This is a project that's going to cost in the many billions of dollars, which is one of the reasons why, the company has been so interested in pursuing the Starlink satellite constellation to provide broadband internet access. They see that as a potentially lucrative project once it's developed by providing broadband internet access to people who either don't have access to it now or have limited and high cost access, and that could, in their view, generate billions of dollars of revenue that could be pulled into the supporting the overall Starship Super Heavy program at some point. How that calculus is really going to work out remains to be seen in terms of how much is it going to cost just to get Starlink deployed. And then how much revenue can they realistically expect and how much profit
the important thing that they can take off of that and then and put in into Starship. But you know, they're clearly they're thinking through those particular issues, and it certainly is a complex project and one that's probably going to take longer than what the company says, simply based on their past record. But their past record has also suggested that they've taken on things that people have dismissed as being too complex and too difficult to do, like recovering Falcon 9 first stages, and have made it at this point now something that's relatively routine. So simply because it's a complex endeavor, you know, it's not something that I would write off a project because of that. It's not a guarantee, obviously, that it will be successful, but they've demonstrated in the past they've done things that many people have considered to be too hard to do. And so simply because Starship looks hard to do doesn't mean it's not going to work.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I mean, that's certainly, they've done some very impressive stuff. I think they've exceeded any expectation I would have had 8 or 9 years ago or something like that, so... So in that sense, I guess I'm just sort of worried that they could get overcommitted to something that's just, I mean, this seems bigger to me than even the SLS project, really.
Well, I mean, there's obviously the risk that it doesn't work out, that they plow billions of dollars in this project and they can't get the vehicle to work, that there's some intractable technical issue that they can't overcome, that there's some shortfall in funding, that they can't get the vehicle developed with the money they have available. Those are all certainly risks. But any major project, you know, in any industry has similar risks in terms of technology and business case and execution risks. This is no different in that respect. Many big projects fail. Many do not.
Yeah, this is true. Well, and then the other problem is that the fit is the main objective on this, of course, is Mars, and that has a lot of other aspects to it, the human factors, all the things that would be necessary to operate on the Martian surface, Mars suits, Mars habitats, etc., that would need to be developed along with the vehicle to get there.
Yeah, and I SpaceX has hinted that they expect that other companies will come forward with some of the solutions to those problems. We have not heard a lot from SpaceX itself about what is the life support system going to be like on Starship. How is it going to be able to support large crews of people for the many months of transit from Earth to Mars and back? Have not heard a lot of those details. It doesn't mean that they're not being worked on. They're just not talking about them at this point. But, you know, the company expects that, you know, an ecosystem of companies will come together enabled by the transportation that SpaceX can provide to handle a lot of those other issues. You know, transportation companies, you know, typically focus on transportation, you know, and let others handle the destination aspects. And I think ultimately for SpaceX that will be the case as well. But we have not seen a lot of details at this point about how that's going to work.
Yeah, sort of a if we build it, they will come type approach. Huh?
Yeah, if you build it, they will come. If you build it and can offer a compelling business case, people will come because they see an opportunity to make money.
Yeah. I guess the other possibility is like that you sort of had earlier comments, is that if they get this flying successfully before the NASA Moon Project gets anywhere, that maybe NASA might use the Starship type thing to go to the moon, maybe, instead of building their own equipment. Is that's kind of only would happen if that actually occurred, probably, that is, they beat the NASA schedule.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, SpaceX would be very happy to sell Starship missions or Starship vehicles to NASA to support whatever NASA lunar plans that it has. I think ultimately the question will be, will NASA be able to do so? Will Congress go along with that opportunity? You know, those are different sets of challenges, but certainly I think SpaceX would be more than happy to have Starship play a role in the Artemis program in one form or another.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. On Artemis, I'm still trying to get an idea. What, how does this 2024 goal is how they actually envision doing this. When otherwise we're using SLS, which we're probably talking Block 1 at this point, not even Block 1B, right? How do we possibly do a moon mission with that?
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look closely at you know, the architecture NASA is putting together, it does not rely very much on SLS. It's a very interesting aspect, and something I don't think gets a lot of attention when people are discussing the overall Artemis program is, you know, the Artemis program has SLS and Orion. Yes, it has, you know, at least an initial lunar gateway with the power and propulsion module and a what they call a mini hab module, and then a lunar lander that would go from the gateway down to the lunar surface and back. Well, the elements of the gateway are going to be launched on commercial launch vehicles. They will not be launched on SLS. The lunar landers, as NASA envisions, will be developed commercially, and they will also be launched on commercial launch vehicles and not the SLS. The only thing that will be launched on SLS for at least the initial lunar landing missions will be the Orion spacecraft carrying the astronauts to go to the lunar gateway and back. So they have, you know, very quietly sort of minimized the dependence on the SLS. To enable the Artemis program to go forward, because most of the other components will launch commercially. In fact, they will be likely developed commercially. That's what NASA is looking at with the lunar landers in particular. And that sort of is a very different way of doing things, and one that lessens the dependence on the SLS, which is why you can get a human lunar landing on just the third launch of the SLS and only the second launch to carry a crew.
So by commercial, we're probably talking Falcon Heavy, I guess.
Falcon Heavy, ULA's Vulcan Centaur, Blue Origin's New Glenn vehicles, those would all be candidates. Northrop Grumman's Omega, if that gets funded for development, could also be an option as well. You know, there are several different options for launch vehicles that could carry components of the gateway or the lunar landers out to the vicinity of the moon. So, you know, certainly SpaceX would be a contender in that, but they would, you know, certainly not be the only player at all.
Open competition. Well, thanks for all the information. I'll clear the line if anybody else calls in.
Thank you, John. Listeners, John cleared the phone line. There's still time if you would like to call us. 1-866-687-7223 is our number. Some other topics, Jeff, that we've been following and that are actually pretty interesting, you know, and who knows where they're all going to sort of turn out and what's going to happen, are happening between now and the end of the year. And I've got another caller, but I do want to talk to you about planetary missions, and this, there's an active year coming up for Mars, but let's see who our caller is, okay?
Sure.
So we'll first take our call. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is David from New Jersey.
How are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Go for it.
So I wanted to kind of be the anti-John and say I'm really optimistic about SpaceX potential here in building this new rocket. But I just want to ask Jeff, along those lines, you know, back in, I guess it was 2014, when the Russia invaded Ukraine.
Your phone line is fading out badly. Can you, I don't know what you can do, but we're missing what you're saying now. Are you still
okay
there?
I can try to call back another line.
Well, repeat what you just said. Let's see if it'll hold up.
Sure. When we were worried when Russia invaded Ukraine about the availability of the RD-180 a few years ago, and all the concern was about the availability of large rocket engines, and John back then was worried about the cost it would take to invest in that, and we have the Vulcan coming up with, the Blue Origin engine. But can Jeff talk a little bit about what his impression is of Raptor? It seems to perform great, and they seem to have a huge pipeline of rockets, engines that they hope to be building.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, certainly rocket engine development's been something that both the national security and civil space arenas have been closely focused on in the last several years, again, as you mentioned, because of concerns about reliance on the RD-180 engine, which powers the Atlas V rocket. Raptor has been developed by SpaceX for use on Starship. There was one of the Raptor engines on Starhopper vehicle that flew today. We're going to see the Starship Mark I, I believe, is going to have three of the Raptor engines. By the time they get to that super heavy booster, that will be the first stage for Starship. I think they're looking on somewhere in the order. The number varies, but I think 31 has been the most recent number of Raptor engines in that first stage, just to give you an idea of how massive it's going to be. Blue Origin has developed its own engine called the BE-4. They have been testing that at their own test site in West Texas. They're going to use it on the New Glenn vehicle. It's also going to be used on ULA's Vulcan Centaur. Both the Raptor and the BE-4 are interesting. They use methane as fuel rather than liquid hydrogen or kerosene. That's an interesting development. One of the reasons SpaceX in particular has pursued what they're called Methalox, methane liquid oxygen engines, is because you can make those propellants on Mars. You can make methane and liquid oxygen from the resources available on Mars, so therefore you could fly a Starship to Mars, refuel it on Mars, and fly it back. It's remarkable that after a long period of time where there is very little development of large rocket engines in the U.S., we've seen the development of both BE-4 and of Raptor, which have both been largely funded internally by the two companies. There has been some degree of government support because of the interest in getting a replacement for the RD-180, but these have been primarily internal programs by the two companies, we're seeing now Raptor is now literally flying. BE-4 will be flying on New Glenn and Vulcan Centaur in 2021. That's the first launch for both of those new launch vehicles. It's pretty impressive that we've seen the development of these engines and taking on some new technological approaches that, again, particularly in the case with SpaceX, have some applicability to the long-term visions of going beyond planet Earth.
So when at one point I thought Blue said something about their test program being hardware rich or something like that, with a lot of hardware in development. And, of course, Blue is very quiet. They don't tell us a lot what's going on. But I've been really impressed with the number of Raptors that they're talking about. They're on serial number 6, 7, or 8 now, I guess. And he's talking about a huge amount of production capability.
Yeah, SpaceX has been Raptor has been in development for several years, and they've now reached the point where they've got a pretty stable design, so they can now focus more on increasing the production of the engines. Blue, as you mentioned, is a little more secretive, so we don't know how many engines they have in development, but they have been continuing to test those engines again at their West Texas test site, and so hopefully. We don't have any BE-4s flying anytime soon, but by 2021, or hopefully early 2021, we'll see them powering two new large launch vehicles.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. It's great listening to you today.
Thank you for your call. Appreciate it. So, listeners, that also clears the line, and there is still time if you'd like to call us tonight. 1-866-687-7223. Mars is going to be pretty busy next year, so it looks like everybody wants to go visit Mars. So talk to us about who's going and with what and when.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's going to be a burst of activity in Mars missions in 2020. The one listeners probably have heard the most about is simply called Mars 2020. That's NASA's next mission to Mars. That is a rover that looks a lot like the Curiosity rover
on Mars now. It's very much based on the design with some improvements. But the purpose of the Mars 2020 rover is to start to collect samples of Martian rocks and soil that can be returned to Earth by later missions. And NASA started the planning process for what they call Mars sample return, with Mars 2020 being that first mission, but with two missions to follow up probably no sooner than 2026, working in cooperation with the European Space Agency. One would be a lander that would go grab the samples that Mars 2020 collected, put them into basically a small rocket and launch them into orbit around Mars. The other would be an orbiter that would go to Mars orbit, grab that sample container, and then bring it back to Earth. And if everything goes as planned, you could have samples back to Earth by about 2031 or so. So that is part of a long-term program, but those follow-on missions are still in the, you know, early stages of planning and are depending, obviously, on budgets both here and in Europe. But Mars 2020 itself is on track for launch in the middle of next year, and that they've been busy working on the rover at JPL, putting the instruments on, checking out all the systems, and it seems like everything is going to plan there. There is a mission called ExoMars, which is a joint project between the European Space Agency and the Russian Space Agency, Roscosmos, that is also scheduled to launch around the middle of next year. It will also feature a lander with a rover, one not quite as big as Mars 2020, but still a fairly capable spacecraft that will include the ability to drill down into the Martian surface. The issue with ExoMars, though, is they have been having problems with the parachutes that will be used to slow the spacecraft down as it descends through the Martian atmosphere. They've been testing these parachutes in high-altitude tests using balloons, and they've had a couple of test failures from recent months. And so there's a little bit of going back to the drawing board and seeing what is going wrong, what's causing the parachutes to tear as they're deployed, which is what's happened on those couple of test failures. And it may be a little bit of a race against the clock to see if they can get that problem identified and corrected and tested in time for that mission to launch in the middle of 2020. Mars missions typically have fairly narrow launch windows that last only a few weeks, and so if you miss the launch window, you have to wait typically about 26 months, a little over 2 years, before you can try again. So ExoMars 2020, if they continue to have problems, may become ExoMars 2022. We'll have to see about that. China is planning its own pretty ambitious Mars mission. China has never launched its own spacecraft to Mars, and so they're planning to do a lot with their very first mission. There's going to be an orbiter also with a lander, and that lander will also have a rover. We have not heard a lot in the West about what the capabilities of all these spacecraft are, what instruments that they have, and whether everything is going to stay on track for a 2020 launch. One of the issues for the Chinese mission is that it depends on the use of a heavy lift rocket called Long March 5. And Long March 5 has only flown a couple of times, and on its second flight 2 years ago suffered a failure. Had a problem with its engines in the first stage, and they have been working to correct that. And they apparently have not quite fixed it yet because the Long March 5 hasn't flown yet. And both the Chinese Mars mission they want to launch in the middle of 2020, as well as the Chang'e 5 mission, which will be a sample return mission from the moon, that was supposed to launch this year and probably will slip into next year, are dependent on the Long March 5. So that's a wait and see moment. And then finally, a new country is going to be launching to Mars, the United Arab Emirates. They are developing a Mars mission called Hope. It's a fairly, relative to Mars 2020 and ExoMars and the Chinese mission, this is a pretty simple spacecraft. It's an orbiter mission. It's designed to study the Martian atmosphere. But it's a pretty big step for a country whose space agency is only a few years old and that has only done a couple of low Earth orbit spacecraft so far. But they are pretty serious about getting, you know, more involved in space exploration. Obviously, they have a lot of wealth that they have available in the country that they can bring to bear on space exploration. And if you talk to the officials in the UAE Space Agency, they see it as, you know, a critical effort to diversify their economy. They realize that they can't rely on oil wealth, you know, into the indefinite future, that they need to diversify the economy into other sectors. They see space as one promising area to do so, and they also see space as something that can provide, it has societal benefits as well in terms of providing a message of optimism, particularly in a part of a world that doesn't always see a lot of optimism. And so that's something that they are actively pursuing, and that looks like that's going to be on track. That'll actually be launched on a Japanese rocket in 2020. So 2020 is, if everything comes according to schedule, and certainly some of these missions are facing some technical challenges, it's going to be one of the busiest years in Mars exploration in a long time.
Very cool. Also, we've been talking about planetary protection and tardigrade incident.
Incident. Yeah.
Yes, I can't even talk. Does this have your attention, or are you just sort of dismissing it as a novelty on the side?
It's interesting from sort of the legal issues that it raises. From the actual planetary protection aspect, there's no real contamination risk. It's not like we've suddenly infected the moon with these tardigrades that will, you know, again, sounding like something out of a science fiction movie, mutate and take over the moon or something like that. We've launched spacecraft to the moon that have carried, you know, all sorts of microbial life that we didn't intend to be on it, but was on it. Some of the experts say that, you know, the tardigrades probably aren't going to do very well on the moon anyway. They may be very resistant to extreme conditions, but the moon is a pretty harsh place with a lot of cosmic radiation and ultraviolet radiation and temperature extremes that are not beneficial to any life form, even a tardigrade. So in terms of contaminating the moon, that's not really an issue. The issue that gets raised is the oversight of private space missions, particularly as they get more ambitious and start to go beyond Earth orbit and start going to the moon and to Mars and elsewhere. And in this particular case, you know, the tardigrades were on this lunar library disk that an organization called the ARC Foundation placed on the Israeli lander. The Israelis knew that the lunar library was going to be on the spacecraft. They didn't know that the foundation had basically dosed the disk with a sprinkling of tardigrades. So they were unaware of that. They had actually, as part of the launch licensing process, because this was launched on a SpaceX rocket from the U.S., as part of the FAA launch licensing process, they had to, for the lander, demonstrate that, we are going to land on the moon, and the moon falls in this particular category in NASA's planetary protection programs in terms of, basically, all you have to do is document that you're going to go on the moon and what the spacecraft is, and you're fine. You don't have to do any sort of decontamination efforts to reduce the load of microbial life on the spacecraft. But what happened is that, what they actually launched was not what was in their license because of the inclusion of this lunar library with the tardigrades on board. And the question is, should have been able to catch that prior to the launch, and what sort of degree of oversight is needed in the future if you're going to someplace that has greater planetary protection concerns, like Mars, where deliberately adding microbial life would be considered undesirable unless you're carefully controlling what shape it's in and where you're going on Mars. So that's something that I think is going to be debated at least for the coming weeks and months. I don't know if it will result in any sort of near-term change in policy, but it does demonstrate that as private ventures start moving out beyond Earth orbit, that we need to rethink some of the issues regarding you know, some of these issues like this, and who should be responsible for the oversight, and so on. This, you know, this particular mission was a fairly complex one. It was, you know, this was a SpaceX launch, but a company called Spaceflight had arranged the secondary payload of the Space IL lander, which was from Israel, which carried this lunar library from the Ark Memorial Foundation. So you had multiple layers of customers, multiple layers where you can imagine things falling through the cracks in terms of the licensing and oversight process, you know, even if things had gone perfectly as planned. So what can you do to tighten that up in the future? What can you do to make sure that you are in compliance with the Outer Space Treaty as well as with national regulations and so on? So it's, you know, as I said at the beginning of this discussion, the concern isn't the contamination of the moon. The moon really has not been contaminated by this. The issue is, what do you do to prevent something like this from happening in the future, where contamination may be a greater concern?
Jeff, we're past the 90-minute mark a little bit. Have we missed something? Is there something you wanted to be sure to talk to us about that we so far have not done so, that you want to bring to our attention?
Yeah. You know, we've talked about, like, a whole bunch of interesting things going on. We could probably spend another 90 minutes talking about other fascinating stuff going on in the area of space. But, you know, I think we've hit on really a lot of the big issues regarding what's going on both in commercial space and space exploration, and also military space.
Any conferences for you coming up soon?
You know, a big conference coming up next month is something called World Satellite Business Week. It's actually a fairly major conference of high-level executives in the satellite business. For all the attention that, you know, we focus on things like small sats and, you know, constellations and, you know, all these small launch vehicles and so on, the bulk of the space business is still made up of launching big commercial communication satellites and using them for providing television and other video and data programming. And so that's still a big part of the space business. It is, though, facing threats from both, you know, emerging space services, but also terrestrial services. As people cut the cord on their cable systems, that means less business for you know, the satellite companies that provide video transmission services. As 5G comes along line, it's a potential threat to satellite broadband. So, you know, it's an interesting time of transition for what is really a major part of the space industry, but one that does not get the same amount of attention as, say, you know, SpaceX's Starhopper test flight, or, you know, CubeSats getting launched from the space station. So that's going to be an interesting conference that I will be at. It's also helpful that's in Paris, so it's a good, nice little trip to go on. But it's actually a very important meeting to get a sort of an update on the health of what I would consider to be the conventional and still overwhelming part of the space industry, facing all the changes that, you know, threaten to upend business plans that have generated a lot of revenue and a lot of profit for companies over the last couple of decades.
Are you going to be at the Space Studies Institute program in Seattle in a couple of weeks?
No, unfortunately. That looks like an interesting event, but, you know, unfortunately that it conflicts with the World Satellite Business Week. I have to go to Paris. It's really, really a shame. But,
yes, I know you're heartbroken. Let's see.
But no, seriously, I mean, I'd seriously consider going to the Space Studies Institute event. It looks like an interesting conference, you know, and certainly a lot of the visions that, you know, Gerard O'Neill put out back in the 1970s, you know, space colonies and so on, for a long time got set aside as, you know, basically science fiction, totally unrealistic. But now with, you know, the development of these new space capabilities, and to see, for example, Jeff Bezos give a presentation like he did here in Washington a few months ago with basically updated versions of space colony artwork that had been done in the 1970s, now updated with his own visions of, you know, he's definitely inspired by O'Neill, and that's definitely driving his vision. It provides sort of a lot, you know, a new life. It, you know, that obviously anything like that is going to be tremendously difficult to develop and tremendously expensive to develop. But that sort of vision has certainly found new life with the achievements and ambitions of people of like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. So it's I think an opportunity, a great opportunity, to sort of look back at what has been done in those areas and what are sort of the next steps that need to be done to enable visions like space settlements to become reality.
Absolutely. Jeff, I want to thank you for returning to the program. I know it's late on the East Coast for you, and we certainly appreciate your being here. And I hope you have a great Labor Day period and holiday, and we'll keep reading your reports in Space News as well as the Space Review. And we thank you for your work, and it's always good to have you as a guest on the show, and I look forward to having you back as soon as possible.
Well, thank you, David. It's always a pleasure to be on the show and talking with you, and your listeners always have some great questions about the various goings-on with space, and likewise wish you a happy Labor Day weekend and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Likewise. And listeners, remember, we go off-topic tomorrow with a special program for an hour at 7 p.m. on the DeLorean car with a great filmmaker. Of course, for true disclosure, that filmmaker is my oldest son. But it is a fabulous story that I've been following with him for years, and I'm as excited today about it as I was when I first heard about it maybe a decade or so ago. So I think you'll like the story, too. So I hope you'll listen tomorrow. Everyone do have a great holiday weekend coming up, and keep it safe. Keep looking up. Good night from Jeff, David, and The Space Show.